So do you want to start with family history, or do you want to start with your history and then go into family history? What would you like to do?
Yeah, I think I'd start with family history.
Okay. Can I get you to just tell me your name?
Yeah.
Before you start?
Oh, okay. It's my whole name. Oh, it's Brooke Hickman. And it's with the Brooke is with an E, because Brooke was a family name on my dad's side. And I think because my dad wanted me to be Brooke, without the E, my mother decided she was going to put an E on it at the end of it. So consequently, I get all kinds of mail for Ms. Brooke Hickman all the time, you know. So anyway. Well, my great-grandfather, Matthias Heckel, was born in Baden-Baden in Bavaria, southern Germany. And as a young man, he did not want to fight. I don't really remember. He died in 1933. I don't know when he was born. But he did not want to fight in the Franco-Prussian War. And so he came to America. And he worked in New York City for a while, and then he moved to St. Louis, and he was an inventor. He invented a stove to heat homes that was designed with a circular flue above it to hold the heat in. So anyway, he was successful for that, sold the patent on that. He was married before he came to the United States, so he had children over there. So he went back to get his family. And then my grandfather, he had like 12 kids. My grandfather was probably in the middle of them. And he was the first one that was born in America. He was born in Brooklyn when they got off the ship and got through Ellis Island. So that was pretty cool. And so then my great-grandfather worked at, I can't remember the name of it, but he did work in Brooklyn. And then he didn't go back to St. Louis, he came to St. Joseph. And at the time, most of the German settlement was about 13th or 14th and Olive or Lafayette, because there was a Lutheran or German Zion church over there for a while. And one of my uncles inherited his shaving cream cup, because there was from the barbershop that they went to on Massena Street, because at the time the men would leave their shaving cream cups there for some reason. So anyway, he invested in properties and was a landlord here in town and became successful. And so later on, he opened the Heckel Benevolent Home at 2nd and Michelle, which is where Wire Rope is now for the remaining time it's there, and Hilliard's is going to take that over. But it was a two-story home for the family, as well as they took in boarders, German immigrants coming to the United States that were trying to learn English to meld into the, you know, and become U.S. citizens, and probably because of all the manufacturing here in St. Joe and or the stockyards at the time. So during World War I, the family had to leave the city limits of St. Joseph, so they moved north about to someplace up on Blackwell Road. That was out of town at the time. And so they lived up there for the duration of war, and then they moved back to town, and he purchased a house on Hall Street. It's not one of the mansions, but it's a pretty nice house on the north side of Hall Street, and so they lived there for a long time. And he also, Matthias Heckel also printed a German newspaper here in town called the St. Joseph Volksblatt, which means People's Voice, which I found a copy of in a secondhand store in Maryville when I was up there. So I gave that to my grandfather, and he donated it to the St. Joseph Museum. Matthias also ran a German beer garden, which was out of town at the time, on St. Joe Avenue. And it was located up by the Dairy Queen. And the building still exists to this day. It's called New Ulm Park, ULM. And it's a rental property now, and it's just south of where the dollar store is. So at the beer garden, according to the stories that I heard, he hosted bare knuckle prize fights. They had a bear that drank beer, and they had a pet monkey named Fritz. Matthias also had what my mother claimed was the first Cadillac in St. Joe. They had a 1905 Cadillac, which was the first big touring model that they could get all the family in and hanging on. And I looked it up, and I believed at the time that a 1905 Cadillac cost $1,200. So that was really quite a deal at the time. He also ran for mayor as a Republican, but he was not elected because St. Joseph citizens did not want a tavern owner to be the mayor of town. So that's the Matthias story that I know. My grandfather, George K. Heckel, when he was a child, he delivered the Volksblatt on a pony to German residents in the North End. So my grandfather and a brother of his, at the time, automobiles were the new thing, you know, kind of like computers, cell phones back then. So they got into the auto repair business, and that's what he did all of his life. And he met, my grandmother was from Ravenwood, and she and her mom and sister and brothers had moved to town. And he met her at one of the dime stores, and her job, she was employed as a pianist to play sheet music for people. Hey, what is this? How does this song sound? You know, that type of thing. Can you imagine that? So anyway, that's the story of my grandfather. He started in the South End at a garage at Lake in Cherokee, and lost his house during the Depression, and raised three kids, and all of that. So that's the kind of the Heckel side of the story. My great-grandfather on the Hickman side was a Civil War veteran from Virginia. He wasn't a Southern supporter, and all I know is that he ended up with his brothers in Illinois, and after the Battle of Gettysburg, they enlisted in the Union Army, and they were in the 11th Illinois Cavalry. And so they were assigned to the border area out here, where there was so much violence, you know, between the Free State and the non-state people, and or the Jayhawks and the Bushwhackers, as they call them. So they disbanded his unit in Leavenworth in, I think, September after the war. And then, so he got some free land over in Doniphan County. So his family and his brother settled over there. So he met, his name was Moy Brook Hickman, M-O-Y. So then my grandfather, Moy Brook, was also born over in Kansas, and he married a woman that lived in French Bottoms named Mary Lee Cordonnier. And Cordonnier name is like really old in St. Joe. They were some French settlers that settled here, you know, shortly after Joseph Roubidoux and that type of thing. So that was the poor side of the family. So anyway, both my mom and dad grew up in the south side, so kind of went from there. Trying to think what else I should say. My dad's dad, my grandfather, Moy Brook, died when my dad was 9, so I didn't know him. And so that was rough on the family because they had five children. So three of them had to go to work to support the family, and my dad was the baby, his older sister, you know, they made do as best they could. They lived at Alabama and Carnegie down there. And my dad told me once that his mom told his sister and him, she gave him 35 cents and said, go up to the valley and buy me a Christmas present. So that kind of, and this was, you know, my dad always said they had their depression before everybody else did, because his dad died in, I think, 1919 or something, and he was a city councilman at the time. So, anyway, that's kind of the history of the family.
What was the valley?
The valley, that was in a part of South St. Joe where, like Helen Wrinkles is, if you know that part of town. It was because it's set in a little valley down there.
So,
yeah.
What about your mom's side?
Oh, my mom's side. Okay, her family was named Moores, and they were from Ravenwood. Her father's name, no, that was her grandfather. Perry Moores was a newspaper guy, and he ran the Ravenwood Gazette, and this is way back when. And he ran off with another woman and went to Lincoln, Nebraska. Now this is like a big scandal, like back in the day. People just didn't do that. So he left my great-grandmother, his wife, and my grandmother, and their kids in Ravenwood. And so they had, you know, back in the day, married women just in a little old town like that didn't get married again. So anyway, there was a benevolent banker up there who basically took care of them. I can't remember what they, my mother had a name for him. They called him Uncle Somebody. So she lived up there until her children got older and then moved to St. Joe. But while they were living there, I remember my grandmother telling me that at the time, it was like a horse and buggy from Ravenwood to St. Joe. And so Uncle Joe, I think that was his name, he would go to St. Joe for stuff, supplies or whatever, and would bring back fresh fruit, and that was their big deal when he got back in the little horse in the cart or whatever with the fresh fruit. So then she moved the family down. My grandmother was playing the piano at Kresge's or something, someplace downtown, and met my grandpa, and so that was that.
Wow. Do you know why the Heckles established the benevolent home?
No, I really don't. And unless, you know, he just wanted to give back to the community that had made him so successful. And he probably felt there was a need for it. And maybe because his educational level was a little bit higher than some of the other immigrants that were coming into the town and stuff, and just give him a step up. That's the only reason I could think of. But, you know, it was a sizable building, and I'm sure you've seen the pictures of it and stuff, so.
Yeah, Trevor sent me a couple of pictures. He even sent me the one with the monkey where everybody's in the car.
On the car? Yeah, right. Yeah, so.
Okay, and do you know what led to them establishing the Volksblatt?
Probably just to serve the German community about what was going on there was no Associated Press or anything, so he could find the news and I guess reprint some of the national stories through what was going on and stuff. So that's about it. I know that somehow he was also involved in the establishment of the German-American Bank here, but I don't know to what extent.
And one more about the benevolent home. Why did they kind of, well, do you know why they established it where they did, where Wairarapa is now, instead of further south?
No, I really don't, because I don't know, unless that was land available at the time, and St. Joe was growing that way.
Yeah.
I mean, but I know the paper was delivered up there, so it just, when you say North End now, it sure goes several miles, you know, yeah, on up, but who knows back then, you know.
Well, and not being from here, sorry, yeah, I tried to imagine.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And from what I've heard, all of the German people kind of tended to settle more south of part of St. Joe. And
so, oh, interesting.
Somebody asked me right before the interview I was talking about it, oh, well, I wonder why they did it there. And I was like, oh.
Yeah, that is interesting.
Yeah. And what about Hickman Market?
Oh, the Hickman Market. That's my grandfather, Moybrook. When he was a young man, he worked at Swift's, I believe, stockyards. And so he accumulated enough savings to start a grocery store at Valley and, it's a Alabama and Carnegie, Valley and Carnegie Street. So they ran that for a while, and probably until he died. And my dad always told me that his mother said the greatest invention ever that was discovered was, this will just shock you, the paper sack, because they'd have to wrap the sugar up and, you know, in newspaper or something and bundle it and tie it and everything. And I mean, people don't even think about that stuff anymore, but he was he enjoyed life, and he took, before my dad and his older sister were born, he took the three older kids to Colorado on vacation. I guess they went by train. He went to the World's Fair in St. Louis, whenever that was, 1890 or something like that. He was a gambler. He loved to stay up and play cards all night and probably drink whiskey, which was why my dad never drank a drop or cursed in his life. My dad, at 9 years old, his dad took him to deliver sugar to down on South 59 Highway. There's a small little town. I just went through it yesterday, but they were delivering it to people that made whiskey down there, that bootlegged stuff, I know. It's about halfway down between Atchison. It's not, so that helped out his grocery business. So that's about the Hickman. That's about all I know about the Hickman store. You know,
you may have said already, but where was it at? Where was it located?
It was at Carnegie and Valley.
Okay.
It's one block south of Carnegie and Alabama. Alabama's that main drag down there. The Mason Road turns into Alabama, I believe. So.
And what happened to the Hickman Market? What happened to the grocery store?
Well, when he died, his wife couldn't take care of it. And my dad's older brother was working. He was an engineer for the city of St. Joe. The oldest daughter, she worked somewhere. And so they just closed the store. And the older children provided the income for the rest of the family. But growing up, my dad told me that he was the baby of the family, and he was the Cordner side of the family were big people. So my dad was he was like 6'4", and he developed into a really good athlete. And he was Benton, captain of the football team, basketball team, track team. his junior year, I believe, or sophomore year, Benton won the state basketball championship. Before each basketball game, his mom, she went to an added expense and they would feed him a steak before every basketball game. And back then, basketball was totally different. You know, the scores would be like 15-9 because they just didn't move around. So, but anyway, it was just part of the family history that I heard, you know, growing up. And so he was 2 years older than my mom when they graduated from Benton in 1933. And so he tried college. He went out to what was then Colorado State University to play basketball, but he couldn't do the grades. And so then he joined a barnstorming basketball team, and they went west, and they were called the House of David, and it was a Jewish team. And in order to play on the team, you had to grow a beard. So he went all around the country, and he would write my mom letters. You know, this was before they were married. And they played the Harlem Globetrotters twice when the Harlem Globetrotters was a legitimate basketball team and beat them once. And so on the way back, he decided that they stopped in Atchison and shaved his beard off because he didn't want his fiancée to see his beard. I have a picture of him and he had his picture taken of the beard too. So just a little something there, you know, so, kind of crazy. But my mom would always say at the high school games, because he was so tall at the time, that was really 6'4" was tall at the time, and he was 2 years older, that the opposing teams would say, "Who's the old man on the court?" You know, stuff like that. But anyway, so.
So after high school, what did your parents end up doing?
Well, my dad went to work for the Light and Power. He worked at the Edmund Street plant down in St. Joe, pushing a broom for 50 cents an hour. And that was when he came back, probably 36, 38. And my mom worked at Big Smith. They made jeans and coveralls and everything downtown in the accounting office. So after they got married, she continued to work, which was unusual for a woman at the time. So then fast forward to 1941, and the war started in December. Well, my folks, I think it was in December, they bought a 1941 Oldsmobile, and it was in storage at Brown Manshrek, transferred downtown, and it was up above, and I'd have no idea what they paid for it. So anyway, then, make a long story short, because my dad was working for the utility company, and he was older, he was in his 30s, he didn't get drafted. So anyway, in 1943 he joined, and he went into the Navy and did his training and went up to, of all places, I think Pocatello, Oregon or Idaho, to do naval training up there. And they told him, because he was so big, he was gonna be SP, shore police. And he said, "It's the only time I talk back to a higher up, and probably an enlisted man." But he told him no, he wasn't going to do that. So they assigned him to be a butcher at the Naval Air Station in San Diego. So because of his age, he didn't go overseas, but that's where he started his Navy career. So my mom and her sister at the time decided, well, we'll just go out to California and get jobs during the war, you know, because her dad owned a gas station at the time. He had enough ration stamps for them to take a car and go out there. So they drove out to California by themselves on Route 66 probably. And my mom got a job as working at the Naval Air Station base on Coronado Island in San Diego. And my aunt, her little sister, got a job in a munitions factory, like a Rosie the Welder type thing. And so there were the three of them, and they were just, you know, they just experienced the war and enjoyed Southern California. And my mother absolutely fell in love with the San Diego area, and my dad always said, well, we should never have left. So, but they did, so. But that was kind of an interesting story.
Did they tell you any stories about what life was like in that part of the country during the war?
Not really. They just, you know, they were doing fun things while other people their age were getting killed and stuff. It was just kind of weird, you know, because they'd go out, my dad would play golf at Torrey Pines, you know, and stuff like that, and they'd go out to eat and have a great time.
Interesting.
All of that, yeah, I know.
A more glamorous picture of the war, I guess.
Yeah, but, you know, at the same time, with the respect and everything of the servicemen. And so my mother's brother, George Heckel Jr., was 2 years younger than her, and he actually saw duty overseas in Germany, and he didn't go in right away. He was over there after D-Day, and he was actually fighting on a street called Heckel Street somewhere over there. And then my mother's sister, Rosemary, was married to a Graham, and they were big truck farmers down in the South End, and he was in, when the war broke out, he was in an ROTC program at the junior college. And so he immediately went into a new part of the service called the United States Army Air Corps. So he was over in England and in France during the war. He was in a terrible accident, almost lost his life. And so anyway, just family stories.
Well, then fast forward to you.
Oh yeah, so my parents got married in 36, and I guess decided to wait, maybe because people that went through the Depression felt like they needed some money, because, you know, my folks, that, you know, they never threw anything away, and they'd always reuse things, and kind of interesting. But so I wasn't born until 1949, and they lived someplace on Edmund Street, like 19th or 20th and Edmund, in an apartment. And so they saved and saved, and the first thing I can remember, we were living on South 28th Street down by the Parkway in a small little house, 2-bedroom house with no basement. One of those pre-war or post-war homes, you know, that kind of went up. And I remember my mom saying that my dad was so embarrassed for the amount of money that he paid, he could never tell his mother what he paid for the house, and it was like $6,000-some. But it was nice. It was on South 28th, and it backed up to the Parkway. And back in those days, I must have been four years old or something, or five, and I ran around the side of the house, and I thought, hey, I just ran around the side of the house. And I had a memory all of a sudden. So in those days, you knew like almost the whole neighborhood. Like I knew like five houses up, I knew everybody and all their kids, and I knew five houses down. So, which, you know, really doesn't happen today. You might know the next door neighbor and the next one, but that might be about it. So, and I think it was because, you know, most of the people had kids that you went to school with and stuff. So it was a nice place to grow up. We played, the neighborhood kids, we would play on the Parkway. This is down by kind of almost to Phil Welch. There's a Parkway area down there now. We would go out and play baseball back in the field. And it wasn't like today, though. I mean, I had one bat, one ball, and one glove. And the neighbor kids, they had a glove and maybe a ball. And one time, we were playing with my ball, which was now turned green, and somebody hit it and went into this little creek, and we couldn't find it. And so it was game over. I mean, you just didn't go tell your parents, and they would go buy you another ball, you know. I mean, I cracked my bat, so we taped it up and continued to play. And it's just like some of the, children now just should be really grateful for the things that they have. But we were grateful too. We didn't care. Let's see, what else? When I got old, I went to hall school, and where we were 1 mile from the school, so we were lucky. We were the last stop on the bus to go to school, and the school buses at those times were old city buses, and because of the baby boom, by the time they got to us, they were crowded, so we stood up all the way to school, which is no big deal. You know, and the guys in the black leather jackets and stuff, this is in the late 50s, you know. They'd sit in the back of the bus and be cool, you know, because they knew that they were going to junior high or high school and stuff. So if it ever snowed and we had to go up the hill, they forced the kids into the back of the bus with them, you know, so it was kind of bad. So anyway, and once I was standing on, we got on and we were right up front by the bus driver. And one of my friends was next to me. He was 2 years older than I was. And the driver, you know, it was a city, had the buses at that time. He had a little round pouch over on the other side of the steering wheel, and he kept sticking his fingers in it and sticking it in his mouth. And I asked John, I said, "What's that stuff Charlie's putting in his mouth?" And he goes, "That's chicken shit." And it was like, I was just, oh my gosh. You know, it really shocked. He knew he could shock me, you know. So, but I'll never forget that. I probably shouldn't have said that, but. So anyway, the general life was we had a paper boy. We had a milkman come. Mom would leave the empty bottles in. She'd have a guy from the dry cleaners come, stop by and pick up her dry cleaning for the week. When I got older, a buddy of mine, we must have been 9, we decided we were going to pack up lunch and take the bus up to Krug Park. So the last stop for the South Park bus was down at by Phil Welch Stadium. So we walked down there with our lunches, got on the bus, rode uptown, got a transfer, rode up to Krug Park and spent the whole day there just playing around, you know, walking around, and rode back home. But, you know, by today's standards, how many parents would let two 9-year-old boys do that today? You know, ride right through town. I think at the time, you know, it was like 15 cents, and then you got to transfer downtown and all that. So, and also then back St. Joe, when I was in grade school, there were just lots of neighborhood grocery stores around, you know, because there weren't any supermarkets. Hall School was on Duncan, 20-something and Duncan, 27th maybe. And there was a store down at 24th, the neighborhood store called Johnny's Market. Well, sometimes when it was nice, when it got spring or May, I would ride the bus home. I would walk with my buddies because they lived close and I just had to walk the rest of the way. But you could go into Johnny's and you could buy the little plastic, it was like, you know, liquid in a plastic pop thing, and you could buy bubble gum for a dollar, you could buy baseball cards for a dollar. So anyway, one day I had 3 cents after school. So I bought 3 baseball cards, and I was walking home with my best friend, and who lived 2 blocks away from Johnny's Market. And so I was just the nice guy. And so this was 1957, I was 8, and I gave him one of my baseball cards, you know. So we're opening up, and he opens his up, and it's a Mickey Mantle card. And Mickey Mantle was a star back in those days. And so I said, "Hey, I want that card back." And he wouldn't give it back to me, but I mean, it would be worth some money today. So just one little thing I'll never forget. Crazy. Let's see, what else? And we would, you know, they had the apple blossom at the time, and we would go to the parade, and it wasn't so much of as a candy thing, and they would have real floats and everything, because basically all the businesses were downtown. all the banks were downtown, all the doctors and dental places were downtown. Some of my mom's, the department stores were Einbinder's for women, JCPenney's was downtown, Kresge's and Woolworth's were downtown on Felix right next to each other. There was a big Plymouth department store. There was a United department store. Mr. Rositsky ran that. There was a store called Grant's. Of course, A.J. August was there. My mom's favorite store was to women's clothing to go into was called La Mode. She took me to A.J. August to buy my school clothes because they had a credit account there. Unheard of. And let's see, she loved to go to the Federal Bakery, which is kind of where Felix Street Park is now. But you could stand outside, it was right on the corner of Felix and something, like 7th Street. And you could watch the bread slicing machine. If you were a kid, you'd stay outside your mom and watch the machine, and your mom would go in and buy the fresh pastries. That was a big deal. And there were all the men's stores later on. There was a lot of Jewish merchants downtown, H.A. August, La Mode. There was a store called Joe Geller's. It was a men's clothing store. There was Ed Kalman's Custom Shop, where all the men bought their real sharp clothes and everything. Paris, owned by the Yannick family. So that was, consequently, there was a really established Jewish community in town at the time, the Block, Paul Block, and his family and stuff. So, those are some of the things. I can only remember being three theaters downtown, the Trail, the Missouri, and the Electric. The Electric was across the street from the Missouri, and they basically showed science fiction and weird movies, so I never went there. But my buddy that I gave the baseball card to, his dad took us downtown. We were going downtown to see a Walt Disney movie. And he dropped us off at the Trail Theater, and we paid our money and went in. And we watched the movie for about 10 minutes, and this is not the movie we're supposed to be at. Well, the Walt Disney movie was at the Missouri Theater. And we were watching Elizabeth Taylor in a movie called Butterfield 8 that we didn't even know what the heck it was. So we had enough money barely left to get into the Walt Disney movie and then call his dad to pick us up afterwards. So that was kind of interesting. There was two Katz drugstores downtown, and they were very popular at the time. One time, some other friends and I, we were just kids, probably 10 or 12, came downtown. We rode the bus downtown, and we were going to spend the day here, and we had a little bit of money, and they wanted to eat at a restaurant on Edmund Street and that I'd never been to, and I said, okay, so we went in, and I didn't particularly care for it because it really wasn't clean. I was used to eating at the lunch counter at Kresge's, you know. So we went in there, and I just had to leave, and so anyway, after I got home, I told my parents, I said, you know, I didn't like that restaurant. I didn't think it was clean. So I went up and ate at Kresge's, and I said, but there was a sign in this restaurant that I didn't understand. It said, we reserve the right to refuse service to anyone. And I asked my parents, I said, why would they not want business? Why wouldn't, and so, you know, this is before the Civil Rights Act of 65. And so then my parents had to explain to me what that was all about. But I distinctly remember that sign and thought, well, that's crazy. Wouldn't they want to, you know, make as much money as they could? You know, and it's the same, my parents went to the First Church of Christ Scientists up here at 12th and Felix, and we would come to town, we were living down on South 28th, we would come up and get on Messina Street, and we'd come up Messina Street, and we'd turn on 12th North to go to church. And so I asked my dad one time, I said, well, why are all the black people, I'm sure I didn't use that word back in those days, live in this part of town? I mean, what's the deal? And my dad, he didn't really explain it to me, but all he said is, they're just like us, son, they're just like us. So, you know, after I got some education and stuff, I knew you know, what was going on. So those are just a few little asides for downtown. I remember that all the time I was growing up, my dad bought used cars. So, except for one time, when the first car they had was the 41 Oldsmobile when I was still a kid in 49. They had it, and I remember it, so add 4 years to that. Had running boards. It had no radio, no nothing but a heater, you know. And I should tell you that when my parents were in California, that every night there'd be a sign on their car. This is during 43, 44, and 45. We want to buy your car, because it was, you know, they did stop making cars. So anyway, they had the Oldsmobile. Then he sold it and got a 49 Mercury. And it had a damaged passenger side door, so my mother didn't like that. So he took the door off, and he'd found one in a junkyard in Topeka. And so my dad and I went on the car without the passenger side door to Topeka, and he strapped me in the car with a rope. And we drove to Topeka and got a door. So anyway, then in September, or maybe it was spring of 1960, my dad decided he could get a good buy on a 59 car, you know, because the 60s is already coming. So they had some leftovers at Miller Chevrolet, which was downtown. So we went to the lot, and he picked out a 1959 Chevy Biscayne, which is the low end. This is 59, it's the big taillights and the fins and everything. So it's cream colored with a bronze interior, and it had a 3 on the tree, no radio, and a heater. And while he was looking at that, I was looking at the real nice cars, you know, and there was an Impala on the lot, and the sticker on it was $3,245. And by golly, I knew that when I got out of high school or college, I was going to buy a brand new Impala, you know, for $3,200 or $400 and whatever, I said, which of course never happened, but I had it in my mind all those school years, you know. So anyway, we took that car up to, they went to Detroit. My dad's sister was living in Hazel Park, Michigan at that time, which is 9 miles north of Detroit, which is just a post-war suburbs at the time. So got us up there and back. Let's see, what else? Any questions you have?
Hall School was that elementary?
Yeah.
So where did you go to junior high?
There's a school in Lafayette called Bliss Junior High. I think it's a senior apartments now. Then you went to Bliss for 2 years, 7th and 8th grade there. I mean, the Hall was at the time, all the schools were full of kids then because there were so many, you know. And I thought it was a great place to go to school. And, you know, I was just a little troublemaker. And when I was in second grade, my buddy and I, and we got a girl to go in with us. So we went out on the playground and we stole the kindergartner's balls and just hit them down to the end of the playground. So we got caught and we got brought in, and the teacher decided that our punishment would be none for the girl, but my buddy Bob, he had to spend the rest of the day in the afternoon in kindergarten class. And I got to stand in the hall all the rest of the day. So because of that, most of the classes moved together, and there were 2 classes for every grade at Hall, like 2 first grades, 2 of them. So I was the only one of my second grade class that didn't move to the third grade. They moved me over to kids that I didn't even know, but that was okay. So anyway, and then I should tell you that in, I think it was 5th grade, they had a program called religious education, and that's where any parents that wanted their children to learn Christian values could walk to a church for part of the afternoon, one day a week, and be instructed by ministers and then walk back to school. So we did most of my fifth grade class, and probably the other class did that. We walked from Hall over to First Christian Church, Wyatt Park Christian Church, which is on Mitchell, 20-something in Mitchell. And all the Catholic kids stayed in the class, you know, which is fine, you know, so that was interesting. And then when the real treat was that when you got to be a sixth grader, you could watch the World Series. The teachers would bring their TV in for like the final two games, black and white, you know. So that was cool. And at the time, you know, you could only get three channels. You could get channel 2, 4, 5, and 9 out of Kansas City with no remote control or whatever. But and then when I was a sixth grader, President Nixon came to St. Joe to campaign. And so they let all the schools out and they went down to the Civic Center Park and he came. And if you wanted to hold a Nixon sign, you could hold a Nixon sign, and then they bused us back to school. So that was going back to Hall. I know you ask about Bliss. So then Bliss melded in Hall and whatever grade schools were close by. I'm trying to think. Sherwood, which is not existent anymore. It was north of the tennis courts over there at Noyes Field. And Blair School, which was out on Rennick, past 33rd, like 34th and Rennick or something. They merged into Bliss, so you were with, you know, people that you didn't know, but it was still okay. One of my memories about junior high, 7th and 8th grade, was I was not too good in math or science. I like the history, I like the English and that type of stuff. So in 8th grade, I, you know, struggled through math class, and the teacher's name was Ruth Martin, and her husband was Richard Martin, and he was the FBI guy assigned to town at the time, which nobody really knew at that time. But anyway, so, you know, it was a celebration. Oh, I never have to go through that again, you know. So I get to Central, and my freshman Algebra 1 teacher is Ruth Martin. So I had to go through Ruth another year, but that's okay. So anyway, so then you take the Bliss, and I'm sure there were some other junior highs around at the time. I just, you know, I didn't know who they were or where they were. So you get to go to Benton Central or Lafayette, or you could go to CB at the time. I think when, by the time I got to high school, there was a Bishop LeBlanc, but it was only for girls. So then you have all the kids coming in to like Central. So it was pretty interesting. And one thing I wanted to tell you was that when I went to high school, there were 1,000 people in my freshman class because there were so many baby boomers going through school. So you went to Hall, you went to Bliss, and then depending on what classes you took at Central, you would never see those people again for 4 years. So you went into Central and they put you into what they thought was your educational level. So there were groups of students that were ones, twos, threes, and fours, and the fours were called accelerated. So I went into Central as a freshman as a two. But I also took Algebra 1 and French 1. So my sophomore year, I was a 2. Took French 2 and something else. So they could tell I was kind of, you know, I had a desire to go to college. So my grades still were hanging in there. You know, I wasn't getting D's or F's, and I was getting C's and B's. So my junior year, I walk in and I'm in the threes. Boy, am I somebody special now, because the threes are all the kids from the north part of town that came in from the really good elementary schools like Noyes, Gene Field. I think there might have been, I don't know if there was Hawthorne, which is now Coleman, but you could tell the difference because that's the area of town where all the doctors and, you know, the real successful people came from. So very interesting. So I had one class at Central with the fours, and that was American literature. I was a senior, and they were, some of them were just fine, and some of them were just, you know, they knew they were so intelligent that they were above everybody else. And we had a kid in my class, it's fifth period American literature, and he was an attorney's kid, and he had already got a scholarship to go to MIT. And so we had three major papers due for in American literature that year, and the final one he just didn't turn in. And Mrs. Frazier, Virginia Frazier, you know, she was the type that you expect to hold a ruler. She said, "Well, now, Jim, you know that you're going to get an F for this." And he goes, "Yeah, I know it." You know, it was just, they were different. I mean, they were very smart kids too. So, but anyway, we would have, you know, the attorney's kids. If an ambulance would go by on Edmund Street there north of Central, I saw an attorney's kid get up once and look, you know, to find out what was going on, stuff like that. But there was a really big Jewish community, and all the Jewish kids at school were just fantastic. You know, they were great, they were funny, they were, and I remember them, and it's just like, you know, where'd they all go? Because, you know, I know that, Dr. Rosenack does the services for the Jewish people now. I mean, he's not a rabbi, but he does them on Saturdays in town for the small group of Jewish people that are still here. But, I mean, there was quite a few of them back in the day. So, anyway, that's my Central story of the ones, twos, threes, and fours.
Interesting.
And the threes and the fours, you know, some of them they would have, like, they turned 16 and they would get a new car. Or my friends, they thought it was cool if they got, I went to Central from the fall of 63 to the spring of 67, and my friends thought it was really cool if they were driving a 56 Pontiac or Chevy, you know. They could just afford that and the gas. So. Anything else as far as education?
What did you do for fun in St. Joe when you were in high school?
For fun in high school? Actually, there was the first Christian church here in town had dances that you could go to, I think, on Saturday night, I think. So there were a bunch of us that went to there, and they would have live bands, and it wasn't anything huge or anything. Or you'd just go out, and or you could go to the drive-in theaters. There were three in town. There was the Cowtown down in South St. Joe on the street that goes to Lake Contrary. I never went there. There was the Skylark Drive-In, which is where Hy-Vee is now. And there was the Belt Drive-In, which is where Anderson Ford is now. So, I don't know, little or no money, you could do that. From time to time, they'd have dances at what was the Frog Hop for our generation, which is where Eckerd's is now, and that's where our proms were held, and it was a really cool place to go, you know. I will tell you that my mother was an excellent cook, but I never had a pizza until I was like 16 or 17 years old, and some of my buddies had cars and say, "Hey, we're going to the new Pizza Hut. You want to go with us?" Well, yeah. So I had my first taste of pizza, you know, and a Coke. And that is a little bar that's now located north of Earl May out on the North Belt Highway. That was the original Pizza Hut in St. Joe. So I know, it sounds strange. I mean, because if you're a kid and you're 6 years old now, you know what pizza is. But I also remember my parents had a big garden on South 28th Street and everything in it. But my mom would go over to Doniphan County and buy cherries. And she made, you know, she made the best pies. I will not eat pie out just because it'll never be as good as hers. So, but anyway, to make a long story short, early when I was a kid, before like 64, there wasn't this barbecue deal in the country, and so we never barbecued unless you went to Krug Park to a church picnic or something. So anyway, what I'm getting at is, when we had ribs, if you think ribs now, you think, hey, barbecue and barbecue sauce. When my mom cooked ribs at home, she cooked them in sauerkraut, you know, German krauthead, and they were delicious. And that's why I thought you fixed ribs. You know, you had that and you had German potato salad, so. But other than that, I mean, you could go to the Dairy Queen. When I was a kid, before I got into high school, and we lived in South 28th, we would go to the Dairy Queen up on Mitchell, and you could get a chocolate malt for 35 cents, you know, just the time, you know. You could go to the drugstore, and you could get a 5 cent Coke, or it was 10 cent if you wanted a cherry Coke, and stuff like that. And we basically, you know, rode our bikes around a lot and stuff, so. Other than that, you go to a movie, you could go to the drive-in, you could go to a school function, or you could, you know, go to, if you wanted to go to this small group and have a live band at the church little annex, you could do that. That was kind of nice.
How did St. Joseph start to kind of change as you got older?
Well, the development of the Belt Highway. When I still lived in town, the stockyards were still going, so that was still a viable income for a lot of people. That and Quaker Oats and wire rope and the factories, some of the factories downtown, and at the time it was called West Tab, which was Mead, which was down here on Mitchell. But then when I was a kid, the early development on the belt was, down, if you go down south, there really wasn't anything until you got to like Carr City, and that was, there was a grill place, a restaurant down there called Miller's Grill, and we would go down there for tenderloins, and they also served brain sandwiches. And there was some ag stuff down there, and then Bouchard Flowers was there. They moved out there real early. And then there was really nothing until you got to Pickett going north, and where McCarthy Baptist Church is was the old Frog Hop that burnt down. And so there was a Frog Hop gas station there. That was about the only thing there. And then on the other side at Belt and Pickett, on the southeast corner, was a restaurant called Les's Chicken Royal. And we would go there occasionally because the food was really good. And then really there wasn't anything to the north until you got just to Mitchell. And south of Mitchell there was a TikTok Motel and TikTok Restaurant, which was on the west side of the highway, and there was a grocery store on the east side. And then if you went on up the belt, probably the next thing, I think there was at Belt and Seneca, there was a fast food place, but I have no idea what the name of it was. And then on the south side, and on the north side, there was a little building with the KKJO FM 1550, a little AM station. And that was just like fantastic, because for the kids in town, the signal didn't hardly go anywhere, but you know, they played the kind of music that you loved in high school. So that was there at Seneca. And then you'd go on up, and then the Skylark Drive-In was where Hy-Vee was. And let's see. Then there was McDonald's came in 66 or 67. And it was just a small little drive-up place. And you could buy their 19-cent hamburgers there. And then there was another place on the west side of the highway called Griff's, which was a hamburger joint. And it was about where, I'm trying to think, Creveston's is in there somewhere today. It was in that area to the north. And then there was the, where U.S. Bank is, that was a place when I was a kid called the Edgewood Lounge. And it was like, I never went in there because it was like a bar or something, a restaurant. And then you went up to the Belt, and it was a cornfield over there where East Hills was until like 66. And the Snow White was there where Walgreens is for a long time. And then to the south of them was a little horrible looking place called Der Wiener Schnitzel that only, it was drive-through hot dogs. That was crazy. So then if you went on up the north, there was the old Pony Express Motel. And then where Hobby Lobby is was a small airport for little prop planes to fly in. And then down where U-Haul was a motel called the Shangri-La. And then you'd go north of that, and it was the North Bell drive-in. And of course, Cool Crest was there on the west side. They were one of the first people out there. Where Behringer Ingelheim is at Gene Field was the originator of that. It was called Anchor Serum. True Davis, who's a big Democrat back in the time, developed that and sold that to Behringer. That was there. And then Kmart moved out there about the same time as East Hills did on Gene Field. And I think the Green Hills was there, and then the Highway Patrol, and over where the new McDonald's is was called a Y Motel, and that was it. So, but.
Wow.
I mean, those are some things, but not too many things, but those are some of the ones I remember.
That was interesting, like, so I could kind of hear it as you were saying.
Yeah.
So what did you do after high school?
Oh, after high school? Well, I had jobs. My dad, I didn't work when I was in high school. I didn't have a car. So I graduated in 67, and I started to look for a summer job. My dad said no. He goes, he gave me a student membership at Fairview Golf Course. And he goes, you're going to be working all the rest of your life? He goes, you might as well take this summer off. So that's cool. I still got that tag on my bag. I played out there yesterday, as a matter of fact. So anyway, I went to Mizzou. I went down to Mizzou and to get into journalism school. And it was difficult because there was people from St. Joe that went, but I didn't really have a friend that wanted to go there. And the other guys that were the threes, they were in fraternity, so I didn't get that experience. So my first year, it was okay. I just took the introductory classes, and it was the first year for daylight savings time in the summer. So that didn't help my second semester grades because we went out and played baseball until it got dark. So I got on disciplinary probation, okay? So I go down and my first semester senior year, I was in one of the old dungeon dorms. So in my first semester sophomore year, I'm in one of the new high-rise dorms, but I'm on disciplinary or scholastic probation. So having been there a year, you know, at the time you couldn't have a car on campus until you were a junior. Well, I had worked summer enough to make some money and save some money, and so I bought this. My dad split this $900 1963 Karmann Ghia with me. Really cool for a college student. Yeah. So I thought, well, I know how this works. I don't have to get a student sticker for it. I'll just go down and park it off campus somewhere. So that's what I did. And so then everybody on my floor at the dormitory thought I was like a really smart guy because I was going to the library every night. Well, it was to get off. So about, I think it was October, November, my parents call me and they say, I say, yeah, what's going on? And they said, well, we're coming down this weekend. I said, really? You know, is the football team was out of town or whatever, and I thought, what in the world are they coming down for? We're coming down to get your car. I said, what are you talking about? Well, we got this letter. They didn't tell me. They sent a letter home to my parents. So they drove down to Columbia, and my mom drives their car back, and my dad, 6'4" dad, drives the little Carmen Ghia back. So guess what? I'm on disciplinary and scholastic probation. It's the double secret Animal House probation. So, my second semester, sophomore year, boy, I was going to the library. So I brought my grades up, got off both of those, and then for the next 2 years lived off campus. And then my junior year, you get into the school that you get in the school that you want. So I got in the journalism school, and so you know my grades went up and everything. So that was a good thing. But I did have the double secret probation. One thing about in St. Joe too is that we never thought about it, but you know I-29 was not completed. When I was a junior senior, it made it to Frederick and that was it. And so what we would do, my friends that had cars, the older ones, you know, we would go down 29 to 36. And then we'd go down to 36 and stop, and it was like a drag race up to Frederick Avenue. And these old cars with no seat belts and everything. It was crazy, but it worked for, you know, a little while. That was fun. That's something else we did after school. So. I'm trying to think if I'm leaving anything out. I don't think so. Oh, one thing we did, when I was a kid, my parents would eat out one Sunday a month. We got to eat out. So I didn't have any brothers or sisters, which I really regret in later in life. But we would get to eat out. So the places of choice were, number one was Jerry Ann's Cafeteria, of course, if you went there. And let's see, the other ones were, we would eat at Wade's Indian Grill. Have you ever heard of that?
I've heard of that.
It's on Mitchell. There's a convenience store now. There's a Speedy convenience store. But they had, it was the all interior was like hand carved of bears and owls. And it was really cool to go in, a great motif. And their specialty was chili. So we would go there. My favorite hamburger joint was called Wickersham's, and it was up on Frederick, across from the old hospital. I don't even know what it's called now. And then, let's see, where else would we go? Jerry Ann's at Wickersham's. Occasionally, we would go to Mawila. My grandfather and my dad and my mom's brother became members, and so we would go there on special occasions, and that was really cool. But we did go, whenever her sister would come back into town, they had to go to Jerry Ann's because they knew the Carolus family, and then the woman that was their age, you know, inherited it, and so they knew Geraldine Lahan. So, but when I was a kid, we would go in there, and you had your choice of like chicken, beef, or meatloaf or something. So you got, I'd always get this meatloaf, mashed potatoes, green beans, a salad or jello, a piece of pie, and a milk. And it was always $1.34. $1.34. I'll never forget that. Any combination of those, you know, no dessert or anything, but that was cool. But I guess that was big money back in those days. So. No. I don't know.
What about after college?
After college? I went to work for the selling advertising for the Maryville Daily Forum. And it was either that, or we were actually on our honeymoon that summer. And I had already interviewed in Maryville. I actually went up to the university to apply there in the public relations department first, but they had just hired someone, and so they sent me to the paper. And while my wife and I were on our honeymoon, I got a call from the placement office down at Mizzou, and the newspaper guy, Rolla, wanted to see me. So we were down, we were honeymooning in the Ozarks, and so we interrupted our honeymoon to go down there, and I had an appointment at 10 o'clock in the morning or something, and he still hadn't come at 10:45, so I just left. So anyway, I took the job at the up in Maryville. And so then the placement office sent me a letter, so they were never going to work with me again, and I was on probation, so I had to explain all that to them. So I worked up at the forum in Maryville for 10 or 11 years. That was really cool. Small town, everybody, you knew everybody. My two daughters were born up there. Small town that people would care, hey, did you hear so-and-so's in the hospital or stuff, or, you know, you stop in to get a prescription filled. Have a free limeade, you know, and all that. So, you know, it was nice. The last 2 years I was up there, a friend of mine and I, we decided we were going to fish, and so we would fish every Thursday night in the summer because it wouldn't get dark until 10 o'clock, and so we'd go all over in the winter, all over Nottoway County, and look for farm ponds, the ones you can see from the road. So then in the spring, we'd call and ask these people, yeah, sure. And we'd go out, and you know, there were just two rules. Lock the gate and don't leave any trash. Great. 2 years, all summer. We only had one property owner tell us no. And we were having fun, wonderful. So then I decided it's time to move on, and so I had a choice of going to the Kansas City Star or the St. John News Press. So we chose the News Press because of the school district. We didn't want to move to Kansas City. And so anyway, you'd ask people about farm ponds in St. Joe, and it's like nobody ever knew anybody that had one. It was crazy. So I worked at the News Press, and it was fun. I worked my way up there. And when the advertising director decided to retire, they brought in a new guy from the Star, and my wife said, give it 90 days. And so the first 30 days, he changed the commission plan. Second 30, he put us into sales territories. And then the third 30 days, he made the sales territory smaller. So that anybody that was doing real well in sales at the newspaper at the time left. One woman went to Cablevision at the time, now Suddenlink. Another woman went to Channel 2, and then I went to the radio station. So, and it really worked out good because it was a time when the papers had started to lose their circulation and everything. When I worked down there, the Sunday paper was like 51, 52 on a Sunday, and the weekday paper was like 46. Well, the weekday paper now is like, they print 26,000, so you don't know, but. So I've been at the radio station since 99. It's a really good company. It's employee owned. And it's been great. Trying to think if there's anything else I left out. Just my summer jobs when I was a kid. The summers I did have to work when I was in college. The first summer I worked for Stuppy's Greenhouse. Stuppy's was a big floral supplier to florists in the area, and they had two sets of greenhouses. They had one outside of town up on North 169 Highway, and then they had one in town just off Ashland Avenue where I think it's U.S. Bank is now. There's a U.S. Bank and a dental office upstairs. Well, that and all the way back to the south was greenhouses, and they had separate rose houses and all kinds of different flowers, and they also grew poinsettias all summer. And so that was my first job. I think it was for $1.50 an hour, and my boss told me, don't tell the other guys what you're getting, because you're going to college and you dated my daughter once. So the first day, they had me put on gum boots and step in this pit that was fertilizer, and I had to turn it over, you know, the whole day. It was heated. They heated it up for some reason. And so I did that, and I came back the second day, and I said, he said, well, you got to do that again. It's a two-day process. And I said, are you kidding me? He goes, yeah, we just wanted to see if you'd come back the second day. So anyway, I graduated to working on the poinsettias. They planted those and grew them and all that. So that was an interesting job. And then the second year, I worked at West Tab. They hired a lot of college students to either load the girls, the high school girls. They had worked the production. They would punch holes in the notebook paper, and they were on whatever they could do that day. You know, once they had punched their accumulated paper, they could go home. The guys, they had load boxcars and fill orders, so that's what we did. And I worked 3:30 to 11. I worked the second shift, which was okay, except I missed Friday night with everybody, all my friends. That's okay. So then the third year, I worked for the State Highway Department. My dad knew a state rep from town. That's how you get on summer helper. Used to be in the back in the day. So I worked at the State Highway Department that summer, and I started out holding the stop and slow sign, and then they graduated me to a tractor. So we went out to the county line on 36 Highway and mowed back into town, and then I also drove a dump truck for a while. So it was a real education, I'll tell you. But the year I worked at the factory at West Tab, I mean, that sealed the deal. Boy, I want to get that college degree. I don't want to do this, you know, that type of thing. So, and then between my junior and senior years in college, I stayed down at Columbia, and I took summer school classes, and I worked down there in the journalism department. So that was pretty interesting. That was a party time. And you know, I went to school, when I was down at school, it was during the Vietnam War, and so, you know, I had a guy at work about 3 months ago. He asked me if I was ever in a fraternity, and he's in his 40s, you know, I'm 68. And this guy sits behind me, and this woman sits next to me, you know, she's got a six-year-old kid, she's probably in her 30s. But he just said, hey, Brooke, were you ever in a fraternity when you were in college? And I said, no. I said, but I was almost in one. And he said, really? He goes, which one were you almost in? And I said, Mekong Delta. And he said, what is Mekong Delta? And I said, it's a part of South Vietnam. And so I said to him, I said, luckily I got my grades up and I didn't have to join. But at the time, I was going to school. When I was a freshman down there, first semester freshman, they had the Pueblo incident where the Pueblo was captured over by Korea. And so we had the first semester kids from back east, New Jersey and stuff, that were just out on a lark that flunked out. You know, we opened up the windows and, you know, waved, I'm seeing you, Korea, you know. But I mean, it getting drafted was on your mind every day, because, you know, particularly a junior and senior year, when you were in an apartment and had a TV, that was on the news every night, you know. And so when I got into trouble with my grades, you know, I knew that there was other incentives, you know, besides getting off the disciplinary action, you know. And so I had to have a science class. In journalism, to get a degree down there, you have to have a language. At the time, you didn't have to take any math classes, but you had to take a science class. And so I thought, well, I'm going to be real cool. I'll just wait till I'm a junior and I'll take geology. So I took Rocks 1. And I was just like, oh, man. And so I can remember going over there just to see if I got a D in it. You know, and I did. They posted the grades, and I got a C- or D, and it was just, oh, man, that's great. I don't have to go. So, but anyway, and then some of the guys, I remember, let's see, I was a junior, and they had the draft. They reinstated the draft. And so there was four of us in an apartment, and two of them were seniors. I was a junior, and there was a sophomore. And so one of the junior guys, we knew it was coming up. We turned on the AM radio station in Columbia. He got an 8.5 by 11 legal pad, and he wrote 1 through 365 down. And he goes, "I'm going to write all these birthdays down as they announce them." You know, so we sat there, and they started reading them off. They got down to number 17, and it was his birthday. And he threw his pen down, and he said, "Screw it, I'm going for beer." So, anyway. So then the next number that comes up was mine, the next birthday, and it was 250. And then the other two guys were in the 300s. So I thought 250 was a little bit iffy, but it wasn't. Once you get off your student deferment, you were put in you got a draft card and it said 1H, which was one hold. And at the time in 67, the war was kind of trying to wind down, but those guys that were earlier than me, like the years to be over there, the really bad years were like 65, 66, and 67. Those were the bad ones. But some of the guys that we went with and graduated, they were still had those early numbers, and they got called in, you know. So just the name of the game back then. But I mean, it was top of mind awareness, that's for sure. That type of thing. That's one thing I remember about that time period.
Was there lots of protesting on campus?
They had one big one. They had one big one in Columbia, where the three colleges down there, the University, Stevens, and Columbia, they all gathered and marched down the street. I think I was a junior. Can't remember that. I think it was 67. Because, I don't know. They had that, but it wasn't, you know, they had the first hippie shops, and they sold the black lights and the posters and all that, and everything was cool, you know. And like the first, I'll never forget, like the first edition of Rolling Stone, I saw that and I didn't know what it was. I should have bought two of them and put one in a bag, plastic bag. And then, you know, when I got off probation, I had my Karmann Ghia, you know, we were really cool. So we could drive around town, and we drove, I think it was it must have been senior year. And we were down early on campus, and some guy was wearing a shirt that said, they shoot students, don't they? It was from the Kent State thing from 66 or, no, later than that, when I was a junior. So where'd you get that shirt? California, you know, that type of thing. But I remember going through that, and then Mizzou would let you, they decided, oh, we're going to let you out, so you didn't have to take your finals, and you had your choice, you could take the final, or take, if you had a good grade, you could just get that grade, so they did that, and let school out a little bit early. I remember that. And I don't think they really had any, they would have concerts down there, but they weren't really off the wall ones. As far as really hard rock, like I saw the Birds, you know, Mr. Tambourine Man, and I forget. But then they were at an auditorium. They weren't even outside. So that stuff was just developing at the time. So.